Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Read Right to Left podcast. I am G from Simply G, joined by my always wonderful co-host, Ray from Whimsical Pictures.
Hi, everybody.
And this month, it is our third year anniversary. Can you believe that, Ray?
Woo! I really can't. We were talking about it before recording. And we're like, how has it been 3 years?
we both know that COVID has just been a blur, but the fact that it has been 3 years is just astonishing. So we're doing a very special episode. And this month, we're going to be talking about autobiographical, or more specifically, memoir manga. We've seen a lot of it over the years, but a lot of it pop up very recently in the last couple of years due to certain publishers.
Yeah, and also, like, just because it's a huge trend in Japan right now, in Japanese manga, to have these sort of... A lot of times they start as webcomics, but nowadays they'll start off straight going to print. But, definitely the trend started with webcomics, where you would have just someone who has some sort of interesting experience, or not, frankly, just use very, very simple art, very, very, a lot of times it's very amateur vibes, to convey their story in a comic format. A lot of time the art is very cutesy, simplistic, and then we get it in print. So there's so much of it. There's a whole section for it in bookstores now, just autobiographical essay manga. And following that, we're getting quite a bit of it in English as well. So
yeah, I wanted to speak a little bit about that because for most people, I don't necessarily think a lot of people who either don't read a lot or just aren't that interested in kind of daily life stories, memoir seems a little bit out of place. The idea of an autobiography or a biography of a famous person, for example, is very popular, and we see a lot of that. But memoir, you don't have to be anyone that particularly notable. Right, you could be anyone. Yeah. You could be, you know, Joe Schmo from off down the street, and that's part of the beauty of memoir is the supposedly is the universal kind of relatability or just the insight into situations that you yourself may be aware of but haven't personally experienced. I remember when I was going through, you know, my literary English degree, the idea of memoir was that anyone can write a memoir. And, like, regardless of how boring, quote-unquote, your life is, it will be markedly different to somebody else's life, and someone will be interested in it. I don't know necessarily how true that sentiment is, but that was kind of how we were spoken to about memoir, and why we see both in the literary circles and in manga, we're seeing a lot of newcomers, amateurs, people who don't have any kind of background or schooling or anything within the arts, wanting to tell their personal story and subsequently finding a real audience, whether it be through social media or some other kind of online publication. And I think there's no better example to that than kind of the first person that most people come think of when it comes to memoir manga, that being Nagata Kabi.
Nagata Kabi, yeah.
Yeah, her memoir has just kind of exploded. It really set the scene and the tone for memoir manga in English, especially. I don't know if that's necessarily the case in Japan, but I think a lot of things are compared now, or or held to that same sort of standard when being licensed and released?
Yeah. So with Nagata Kabi, we have sort of an ongoing saga with my lesbian experience with loneliness, followed by the two volumes of my solo exchange diary, my alcoholic escape from reality, and most recently, my wandering warrior existence. And probably there'll be more. I mean, I think we're all familiar at this point with the combination of excitement and dread that accompanies an announcement of a new Nagata Kabi book.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Nagata Kabi, basically, is someone who, at least in the first memoir that she wrote, My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness, she just went to detail her experience feeling so depressed and lonely and unlovable. But also, like, realizing that she's attracted to women, potentially, and ultimately calling an escort agency, a lesbian escort agency, and having her, well, attempting to have her first sexual experience. And then sort of all of the feelings leading up to that and after it. To be honest, that actual experience in the title is, like, a tiny blip in that book. And really has nothing to do with everything after that, where basically just Nagata Kabi, okay, is struggling. Oh boy. Oh boy, is she struggling. She's dealt with a lot of very severe mental illness. With very complicated relationships with her parents.
Unresolved trauma as well in her past, reading
unresolved on. So much unresolved trauma that, like, keeps coming up. Like, with each new memoir, she's like, oh, by the way, I kind of, like, remembered this trauma that I'd blocked out of my memory for years and years.
And you're like, okay, cool, wow.
Oh, well, that explains even more. As we get further in the series of memoirs, I think one of the most interesting things to me is that it becomes more and more of a meta-narrative, because she is writing these in real time, and, like, the second one, My Solo Exchange Diary, is a response to her parents finding out about her first memoir, in which she is not very nice to them. Not very gracious to them. And the fallout from her parents finding out, I mean, that irrevocably changed their relationship and probably will never heal. But then, like, also, so she, like, she'll go through these phases where she's like, I'm never gonna write another page of memoir. But then ultimately finds that it's the only way that she can reliably make money. Ultimately, in the most recent one, My Wandering Warrior Existence, which is certainly the most positive out of them, which is good, she finally realizes that she does genuinely love the format of memoir, and starts diving into some of her reasons for that, and goes into more of a episodic essay format, trying to work through, just peel back layers of trauma and figure out what is going on from a more self-aware perspective, I think.
Well, again, I think that's part of the function of memoir, is to examine your own life. And we see this almost perfectly through Kabi's work, wherein, as you said, Ray, My Solo Exchange Diary is a direct, you know, response to my lesbian experience with loneliness. and how her family mm-hmm. reacted to that, how society and her fans reacted to that, her mm-hmm. own perception of herself, her own perception of her place within this family dynamic, and her self-perception of the family and how she's been doing. And you know, there are a lot, there are so many ups and downs when it comes to Kabi. And every time she feels she's in a good place, she's not actually necessarily in a good place. She's just self-medicating in a very harmful way that she's ignoring for a while until it forces her to confront her really mm-hmm. horrible self-medication. But I do think that through the power of memoir and through her re-experiencing or retelling these stories, it lends a genuine element that I don't necessarily think she'd have the confidence to sit down with her parents and have that conversation, or mm-hmm. with her friends or family or whatever else. It mm-hmm. allows her to be, to a certain extent, her most authentic truth, quote unquote, but also allows her to go back and reread and reflect on her feelings in that moment and reassess how things have changed over time, or now that other people are aware of those thoughts. And that's something mm-hmm. that I think a lot of people struggle with, is being so within their own head and their own situation that they don't recognize, whether it be support structures or communities or whoever else that surrounds them, and also don't recognize their own behavior for what it is. And as you said, like, every single one of her memoirs is just that little bit more hopeful. but mm-hmm. she's got a long way to go. Every time, as you said, every time a new one of her memoirs is announced for licensing, or even announced as, like, being published in Japanese, it's like, oh man, I sure hope she's in a better place. You wish the best for her.
Yeah.
But it really is an uphill battle on so many fronts for this poor woman.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting to see maybe the readership perception compared to My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness, compared to My Wandering Warrior Existence, and how even titles can really change who's buying things. I remember when Lesbian Experience came out, there was a lot of emphasis on her lesbianism, which I don't think is even, from her perspective, a huge part of it. I mean, it's obviously an aspect, but it's not a story about lesbianism.
And it does, it ends up leading to a lot of, like, confusion from readers as well, because, like, you see her even in, like, a couple of the more recent ones. Now there's an ambulance, that's great. you see her in the more recent chapters in her ongoing memoir series. She talks about how, like, she's not even sure, like, what her sexual orientation even is, because she really mm-hmm. doesn't have any experience at all. And even from the first one, we've seen, like, we're using terms like she and her and woman for her, but I'm not necessarily even sure they're the most accurate, because she mm-hmm. also goes back and forth on questioning her gender identity. So it's like, yeah, the title My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness, I think, really gave sort of a false sense of what is really being emphasized here. But also, like, would people have picked up that book in the first place if it didn't have that kind of, like, sensationalized title, I think is an interesting conversation to have as well.
I just remember when that first book came out, there was a big discussion about how Kabi's experience as a quote-unquote lesbian woman was, like, central to that piece. And I don't inherently agree with that, especially because of how much it's more so focused on their mental health, their family relationships, and as you said, their kind of confusion of intimacy and relationships in general, just due to not having a lot of personal romantic experience, not having a whole lot of affection, either perceived affection from family mm-hmm. and friends and things. That, I mean, regardless of Kabi's gender identity or sexuality, I think it's something that does have a broader appeal for people who are suffering with eating disorders and mental health issues and family dysfunction or isolation, you know, societal isolation. There's so much going on.
Yeah, and that's not too erase her queerness at all
either. Oh, of course not. Yeah, no.
I think it's still, you know, obviously very, it affects her a lot, it affects her narrative mm-hmm. a lot, and certainly the sense of isolation and being unlovable, being unable to be understood by others, that sense, I think, is definitely influenced by her queerness. Mm-hmm. And then I also just wanted to mention something that I think is interesting about this memoir series in particular. We mm-hmm. talk about the response from fans and stuff like that being interesting, but I think, like, the fact that Miss Kabi spends too much time on Twitter and takes questionable advice from her fans on Twitter more often than would ever be advisable is extremely interesting. The fact that she is just chronically online and, again, you know, as someone who's very lonely and doesn't really have a lot of IRL friends, it's like, you know, she seems to tweet too much. She talks about it, and the fact that that becomes, like, a two-way street, where it's, like, she'll say, like, oh, I got this advice from someone on Twitter, and then I tried it, thank you, or I tried this, and it was actually stupid, and, made things worse, thanks anyway, or, you know, that, I think, adds, like, a whole layer to the meta-narrative here, that is kind of, like, related to isolation and its relationship with, like, parasocial relationships and the relationship between creator and fan that I think ends up coming up in a lot of interesting ways in this series. It's really, like, her interaction with the fans is so integral to her own story at this point. It's quite mm-hmm. interesting. Absolutely. And again, it's not necessarily good.
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There's absolutely a parasocial relationship going on there. And you kind of don't want to encourage it, but at the same time, how many social relationships does Kabi have in her life?
And yeah, and also, like, she has gotten some genuinely life-saving advice, so
I mean,
it's kind of a for better or for worse kind of situation, mm-hmm. but I just think it's interesting, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think Kabi is really, as mentioned, 10, 15 minutes ago, she's kind of heralded, especially in the English sphere, as, you know, the pinnacle of memoir, not only because of being one of the first, or at least widely known, memoir manga available in English. She wasn't the first, but certainly got a lot more promotion and marketing than other memoir series. But because of just the wide breadth of just things she's going through, all of the experiences that she's having, that do absolutely appeal to, or maybe not appeal, but resonate with a lot of young people, whether in Japan or overseas, right? Or just general, like people in general, right? The uncertainty of life and various vices and various mental health issues or physical health issues. It's just very, very interesting to see so many issues in one book. And typically, like, obviously a lot of different traumas stem from things, like certain traumas, but normally memoir is about like one issue, quote unquote. One particular aspect of your life, or, you know, trauma from your childhood or past or family relationship. But Kabi has everything. Kabi has so many things that she's dealing with, and is kind of an all-in-one, experience, which is also, I guess, pertinent to say, if you haven't read any of Kabi's work, it is very heavy. It's not an easy read. It's not a light read. It can be very hopeful, but it's not. If you yourself are not necessarily in a great place, take some caution when reading about some of her personal struggles, because she is very upfront and, you know, succinct with the various things that she's gone through.
Yeah. Yep. And then did we want to comment on the art at all?
Yeah, I as someone who is not an artist, her art is very serviceable. She has been trying to break into being a full-time mangaka for a while, is my understanding. So she has a good understanding of artwork, but it's not, like, highly detailed. Like a lot of these memoir manga, it's quite simple, quite straight to the point, and doesn't get lost in excessive background detailing or anything like that. It's very, very easy to follow.
Yeah, I think... I wasn't really paying that much attention reading My Wandering Warrior Existence, but I think she still mainly sticks to the 4-coma format, where it's 4 panels per page. But then I think that she does utilize some, like, interesting ways of sort of visually representing the things that she's going through. I think for this kind of highly simplified style, she's definitely one of the better examples of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't think you're reading her stuff for her art, in general.
Mm-hmm. And I think, comparatively, that's a good point, comparatively to other manga that are more, like, plot-focused or, you know, fictional kinds of stories, or even non-fictional stories, the manga community always does focus on art and, like, how highly detailed something is or how stylized or whatever. But with memoir, you really can get away with being very, very simple, which is, you know, just a fact of a lot of these people being amateurs, not necessarily having any kind of artistic training, just wanting to tell their personal story in the easiest way that they can. And so it does, I think memoir oftentimes does stand out a little bit comparatively to the more general manga that we're seeing, you know, in a fictional line getting licensed.
Yeah, I would call her art very easy to understand and very efficient. She's often, like, juggling various different mental states or, like, a lot longer passage of time than she's able to show in her page count, and I think that she uses her artwork effectively to convey all of that without confusion. Her stuff is not confusing to read. Which is not easy.
Yeah, no, it definitely is a art, and she does it very, very effectively.
Did we want to maybe, since we mentioned how Nagatakabi's stuff is not necessarily what people looking for LGBTQ representation are necessarily going to be looking for, do we want to talk about some memoir manga that perhaps are more in that vein?
And we've gotten a lot of it over the last couple of years. Yep.
We have. So I wanted to talk about one that I know you haven't read yet, you said. But we do have one called X-Gender by Asuka Miyazaki, who is X-Gender, obviously. This deals a lot with, honestly, it deals a lot with their, like, struggling with their sexuality and how it manifests through being an X-gender person who experiences a lot of body dysmorphia, dysmorphia genocte, dysphoria, you know what I'm saying, dysphoria, specifically for them, they, like, very much want to have, they want to have a dick. Like, that's what they want. More than anything in the world. Even though there are other parts of their body that they really don't want to have, like, quote-unquote masculinized. That is the one member that they, like, desperately want. And I would say it gets fairly explicit talking about that aspect of dysphoria. They seem to be quite a hypersexual person, so that comes up a lot throughout the book, which I thought was interesting. Otherwise, it's like I'm struggling to find more things to say about it because, like, there's not a whole lot super interesting going on in their life, you know? they're just vibing, you know? They're hanging out.
Just vibing and being X-gender, wanting a dick, like, super bad.
Wanting a dick, super bad. but I found it very informative in terms of, like, talking about their experience being X-gender in Japan. They are very, very much, I think, trying to educate readership on what it means to be X-gender. So you get a lot of, like, explanation about, like, you know, yeah, this is my experience. They definitely feel X-gender in that they feel both male and female. But they're very clear on saying, you know, there's, you know, as many different ways of being non-binary or X-gender as there are non-binary and X-gender people. There's, like, all these different words that people use. Some people might feel like me, but other people might feel like they don't have a gender at all, or, like, they're sometimes one gender and sometimes another, or, like, they're in the middle somewhere. So I think that it's very informative in that regard. But otherwise, this was, like, a library kind of read for me, I think.
Like a one and done. That makes
sense. Yep. It's like, I got the information, I'm good.
I think a similar title, in the same vein as well, is The Bride Was a Boy, for me. Which is very sweet, very lovely. Similarly, like, very educational about trans issues within Japan and Chi, the mangaka, her experience as a trans woman, which is a little bit, like, quite different from I guess, quote-unquote, general trans people. She had a lot of support, both from her family and her partner, throughout her life. But it is, like, it's there to educate people about trans issues, or what even transgender, like, what is transgender for an audience who may not be aware. So, for, or even, like, gay marriage and the various things that Japan has in place for queer people. And her kind of perspective of the queer community within Japan. Because although she is a trans woman, she's in a heterosexual relationship. So she doesn't, you know, she personally doesn't suffer from, like, the stigma of being in a gay relationship and gay marriage being illegal and all these sorts of things. So it's very good. It's very sweet. I teared up when it got to her wedding and her gender-affirming surgery and all of these things, but it isn't something I personally would return to unless I was wanting to give someone kind of a pretty basic understanding of what transgenderism is, like what being transgender is, what it means, and also like very specific information for that aspect of the queer community in Japan. I would say that maybe more people within the West have become more aware of trans issues over the last, I don't know, couple years. That it feels a little bit too baby steps, which might be fantastic for the Japanese audience, isn't inherently appropriate for, especially for like you and me who do have kind of a pretty okay knowledge of the queer community, or at least some aspects of, like, we know what trans people are, hopefully. Like, I assume
you know we what know the 101 stuff, at least, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, do you feel the same? Or is...
I think with X-gender, I think that it does get into more nitty gritty. I also think it's useful for Western audiences in particular because the experience of being X-gender in Japan is quite different from the experience of being non-binary in the West, from what I understand. There's a lot that's like different about it, and I think that on its own makes it a worthwhile read. I also think that like I learned some, I think, or it put some things in perspective for me as someone who isn't X-gender, where I was like, oh, so that's how it is, you know, or so that's how that might feel. So I think that it's more than a 101 explanation, I would say. It's a more higher level explanation, if that makes sense.
Oh, no, absolutely.
So I think it is worth a read, but it's not a buy kind of title for me, because I don't think I'll read it again. But I think it's worth picking up. Yeah. And then I also wanted to mention Until I Meet My Husband, which is written by Ryosuke Nanasaki, and the art is by BL artist Yoshi Tsukizuki. Ryosuke Nanasaki is an LGBTQ activist in Japan. Unfortunately, I don't know that much about him beyond the sort of famous news event that this volume culminates in, which is that him and his husband had the first religiously sanctioned gay marriage, same-sex marriage in Japan. Mm-hmm. They had a Shinto wedding. And this is a manga adaptation of his memoir of his life leading up to that marriage. And the art, first of all, is very beautiful. The artist here, again, is an established BL mangaka. It would seem that he specifically went looking for a BL mangaka, based on his note in the back, which I think is interesting. He talks about how he thinks it's an interesting crossing of worlds to have a gay male activist working together with a BL mangaka. But that artist's artwork is just very beautiful. It's lovely to look mm-hmm. at. It's pretty. It's pretty. Mm-hmm. But other than that, this was one where I did struggle with it being too, like, 101 level for me.
Mm-hmm.
It did, like, put into perspective for me, I think, how much things have changed even in Japan, even in the last few decades.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I feel like growing up gay in Japan now is different than what he went through, and I think that that's interesting to think about. it felt like a very, very typical coming out to gay marriage narrative. Like, it felt mm-hmm. like something that I've read so many times before. And to think that we would come to a place where I could say that, like, yeah. is kind of incredible. But where we are now, it feels basic. And it feels mean to say that about someone's life story.
Yeah.
But that is how I feel. And I also feel, I mentioned to you before, but I think it's very truncated. Like, it feels, the pacing feels off here, and that's a place where it just makes me want to read the original book. Since this is an adaptation of a prose memoir. So it makes me feel like maybe it was a little bit clunkily translated. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's my thoughts on that. It's not bad. It's just kind of basic.
Yeah, I can't really speak to this one because I haven't read it yet. Again, because I'm waiting for my print edition of both the manga and the actual novel to come mm-hmm. to my comic shop. So I'm waiting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's an interesting one in that we have gotten both the novel version and the manga adaptation kind of together in the same month.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, we get one or the other. Or if we get both, it'll be months separation. But I think especially with Seven Seas, and we're allowed to talk about them now because they've done the good thing. They are trying to be more proactive with their LGBT titles in general. And I think it's just kind of just indicative of their particular place within the market, with whether that be LGBT manga or memoir manga. A lot of the memoir stuff recently has come out from them. Mm-hmm. And I, as someone who obviously does read novels, does read manga, does read whatever else, I'm always happy when we get multiple versions of things. And I am looking forward to seeing, like, how the novel reads comparatively to the manga, and what the manga especially saw as, like, the most important parts to adapt. That's,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a very conscious decision. And you, Ray, saying that, you know, it does feel very 101, it does feel kind of very rote or expected, especially for someone who has experienced a lot of similar stories. It'll be interesting to see, especially because this particular writer is kind of a very well-known advocate within Japan, how that changes between formats and between prose styles, because obviously you can get across a lot more information within a novel in the same amount of pages compared to like a comic version of that same thing.
Yeah, and you'll have to report back after you read both of those, because that'll be interesting to hear. Did you have any more that are about queer subjects that you wanted to talk about?
I don't think so. A series that I want to read because I discovered it through a different manga that I read this week, which was To Strip the Flesh. There was an interview with the mangaka of that book, which does feature, it's not autobiographical, although it's kind of quasi-autobiographical. The author talks about their own gender dysphoria and their own perception of their body, kind of influencing the main story of that short story collection. And because of that, there was an interview at the end with another mangaka who has gotten quite popular over the last couple years, and he has done kind of like a Twitter manga about his experiences as a gay sex worker, and I'd be pretty interested to read that. He's also written a novel about his experiences. I think he was a gay sex worker. He's also a gay host, something like that, and has a couple various kind of memoir manga that he's put out over the last couple years that I'd be pretty interested to read.
One that I wanted to talk about, that's another from this sort of more recent batch of very simply illustrated amateur comics, memoir comics, essay comics, is My Brain is Different, Stories of ADHD and Other Developmental Disorders, by a creator called Monzusu. Monzusu is a mother who was diagnosed as an adult with ADHD after learning that her child also has a developmental disorder, and from there she sort of became interested in developmental disorders and learning more about them. And she interviewed a lot of different people with developmental disorders, mainly learning disabilities, ASD, autism spectrum disorder, and ADHD are the main ones that show up in this. So she collected those interviews and then turned a handful of them into manga, short stories, including her own story. So the first story in this book is about her, but the rest are not strictly autobiographical, they're biographical. I picked this up because I have ADHD myself, for one thing, but also I'd been hearing a lot of positive buzz throughout, you know, Twitter and various places I hear people talk about manga. So I picked it up, and yeah, it's very good. It's very, like, if you're someone who struggles with any of these things, it is... It does make you feel less alone, I think, in the world. It's very frank about discussing a lot of different issues that people with developmental disorders struggle with. And it's nice that it covers such a wide array of different people and experiences. In particular, I thought that there was an interesting, like, back-to-back pairing of two stories that were both about people with autism spectrum disorder. And I think maybe learning disabilities and ADHD as well. Like, it was multiples, right?
Yeah.
And first you had a boy who grew up with a very good support system around him, and he struggled a lot, but in the end, his story ends very optimistically. He ended up finding friends who understood him in high school and became, like, very, like his grades improved. He had teachers who understood him. His parents understood him the whole time and were fighting on his side. And he was able to sort of enter the workforce. And, you know, he's doing good. And then there's this, a girl with the same diagnosis, who unfortunately didn't have that support system growing up, and had sort of came from an abusive background with a gambling father, and a mother who was just too exhausted by everything in her life to deal with her daughter. And they're all in poverty because their father, like, gambles them out of house and home constantly.
And her siblings are just as bad as her father, like, just as entitled and selfish.
Yeah, well, and one of them is also dealing with severe developmental disorders that end up never getting diagnosed. And ultimately, like, her mother ends up getting a divorce early on, and ends up falling ill in, like, her 40s or something, and has to be taken care of, and she's the only one who's willing to take care of her, but also she can't hold down a job. Like, the way that things spiral just from not having a support system to begin with into not having the education that she needs to get a proper university education, to not having the skills
for a diagnosis, even, right? Like,
not having the information for a diagnosis, not having the life skills to hold down a job, and never once realizing why she hasn't been able to hold down any of these jobs, and never really having the opportunity to ask herself why, until much later she sort of by chance ends up finding out that she has developmental disorders. And so I thought that contrast was very enlightening. Just, like, how monumental a difference a supportive home and enough money to get by can make. And how, when you hit the intersection of physical disability and developmental disability and poverty, things can spiral so quickly out of control.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, one of the, that particular story, personal story of that woman, who, when she's telling it, she's in her mid to late 40s, which just makes you kind of imagine, what if she'd had that support system, what if she'd had that kind of insight to herself so much earlier on, the kind of difference that would have made to her life, to her relationship with her family, to whatever. And I mean, it's it's not conducive to really keep yourself thinking in those what if situations, because obviously, like, when things happen is when they happen. But it is really hopeful that, you know, now that she does have those tools, now that she does have that diagnosis, that she is able to more accurately or helpfully live her own life, understanding herself and understanding this aspect of her life that she just didn't really ever get. It is, in its way, despite being one of the darkest, I'd say, stories of the piece, very hopeful for the future and hopeful for the rest of her life, because it, like, it's fabulous, it's fantastic, when people have those support structures young and kind of grow up within a very safe environment amongst people who understand them. But there's something really, yeah, just jubilant about older people discovering something about themselves that just seems to explain everything in their life up until that point. It's a really interesting contrast, as you said, and I think there's a lot of those in this particular book. I was going to say, and every single one of the stories is really powerful in their own way.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that I really like the wide variety of stories featuring a parent and their child. Are sort of contrasted with each other throughout this book. Obviously, there's the story of Monzusu herself and her child. Well, her children, really, but one child in particular. But there's other stories throughout the book where you have sort of a parent discovering more about themselves through discovering more about their child, which I found very sort of heartwarming, I guess. I found those stories really compelling as well.
One of my favorite stories in this book is, and it's similar to that kind of parent-child relationship, but it's the story of the woman who both her husband and her child had developmental
issues. Yeah, I like that one.
And through helping their daughter, she was more able to understand her husband, and also her husband, even in an unwilling or unnoticeable aspect, was growing closer and kind of managing his own personal issues. It was very, very, very good. And it was really an insightful look at, like, how just in the change of a circumstance, how someone can change because of, you know, how they perceive the world differently that you might not inherently be aware of. In this particular case, her husband really couldn't deal with kind of changes in situation. So after the birth of their daughter, he grew very emotionally distant, really didn't connect with this baby whatsoever.
And he developed an unhealthy attachment to his wife. Has a lot of issues with sensitivity to sound. So the crying of the baby really was upsetting to him.
Which is all very valid and is all very just like how his life has always been, but it's not something he's ever had to confront before. But now, as part of a married couple with children, both of them are now having to adapt to that. And rather than breaking the family apart, which it really seemed like it would at some points, it's been an opportunity for them to grow closer and for them to really come together as a family. And he's gotten a lot closer to his daughter over the several months and years that this is taking place. She's gotten a lot more comfortable with understanding, you know, her, both her daughter's needs and her husband's needs and how to manage them at the same time. It's very, very good. And I think really, again, very hopeful for people who possibly don't have any sort of like developmental or mental disorder themselves, but live with people and care about people who do. It's very good. And I think it's just a really interesting insight to that parental dynamic that isn't necessarily like the mother-child thing as well, because we had a lot of mother, mother-child relationships, and this being both parents and most, more notably, like a father-daughter experience was really, was a big point of difference, and I think it was done, were very interesting to read, very insightful.
Yeah. It's a good collection.
The other one that I wanted to mention in this kind of simple artwork to the point memoir, there's a couple, but if we're talking about Seven Seas titles, which all of these previous titles have been that we've spoken about, I wanted to talk about A Life Turned Upside Down, My Dad's an Alcoholic, which obviously is about parental alcoholism and the trauma, the generational trauma that that has. I don't know if you've read this one, Ray.
No, I haven't had the chance yet.
So this is about a woman who, growing up and up until her, you know, current, her father suffers from alcoholism. He's always been a pretty avid drinker. It's always been something that affected their life, and obviously because of that has had an impact on the family dynamics, had an impact on the family income and her relationship with her parents, and most notably the relationship with her father. And I appreciated this one a lot because it does acknowledge the very difficult situation that addiction and notably alcoholism is, right? Like, addiction is an illness. It's something that is very hard to overcome without any sort of support systems. It's not just, you know, lack of will or whatever. It's not a moral failing. But for our main character, or for our writer, even though she acknowledges that, even though she acknowledges that, you know, there's a lot going on here, and her father's just as much a victim as she and her mother and the family is, it doesn't mean that what she experienced and what her father inflicted on her and her family throughout her growing up should be forgiven or should be hand-waved. Just because, you know, it's so hard when we are talking about addiction, because it brings out the worst in people regardless of what kind of addiction it is. And it is so hard to manage, and you do really need that very strong support system. But every addict, again, regardless of, like, what substance or what you are addicted to, has a really negative effect on your family and the people around you, because it rules your life. It absolutely rules your life. And even though you, as an addict, are a victim, you're also victimizing others, and you're traumatizing others, and that's just as valid, if not more valid. And a lot of this book is her being okay with being not okay, and having that very complicated relationship of, like, this is my father and I do care about him. I don't want our last relationship, or I don't want things to inherently be horrible, but also I need to acknowledge that he's made my life horrible. It's very good, and I think it's, again, one that might, I don't want to say appeal, but I think a lot of people can relate to, regardless of if it's alcoholism or not. I think a lot of people deal with addiction within their family and can recognize a lot of these behaviors and a lot of these relationship dynamics. And I just really like the acknowledgement of, in this case, you know, both aspects of victimhood and both being valid, and not downplaying one or the other, but not, you know, allowing someone to get away with the hurt that they've caused because of other aspects. It's complicated. None of these, I don't think any of these situations in, especially when we're talking about, like, issues, quote-unquote manga, memoir manga, have easy solutions or easy ways to fix things, aside from a lot of fucking therapy. But I do think that it brings up a lot of these aspects that affect lots of people. Obviously, it's not just an inherently Japanese phenomena. It's not just inherently a father phenomena either, right? Like, alcoholism especially shows itself in all sorts of ways. And it's very applicable to just this idea of addiction and relationships with addicts and how you can care for someone but also not inherently you are hurt and you acknowledge that hurt from them and you might never forgive them for that, right? Because to a certain extent, they don't deserve to be forgiven, unless there is noticeable and actionable change being happening either. Again, it's very complicated. It's a very heavy topic, but very, very good. And I think it's the way the cover's drawn and the art style is very... The art style isn't inherently evocative of Kabi, but I think it's one that definitely was able to break through or break out because of its similarities to certain topics that Nagisa Kabi had spoken about. And I'm fairly unsurprised that we did get this one in English.
Yeah, it's definitely one that I want to check out. I just haven't gotten around to it yet. But, yep, rough subject matter.
And I think as well, like, when you look at, I mean, that one's really rough, but when you look at things, a lot of memoir manga, it does deal with kind of people at their low points. Because that's when they want to reflect on how they overcame that or how it changed their lives or how it shaped them into the person that they are. Doing Time is a memoir that Ponentmon put out about someone in prison, their experiences within the prison system. Disappearance Diary is another Ponentmon title about, again, kind of just someone's personal memoir and their struggles with addiction, alcoholism, again. There's a lot in that kind of vein, as well as, like, being a struggling artist. There's a lot of memoirs about being a struggling artist.
Yeah. Which kind of makes something like The Bride Was a Boy all that more interesting among all of this. Did you want to talk about your other absolute favorite memoir manga of all time?
Oh, yeah, okay.
That you loved so much?
Yeah, my favorite. I say facetiously because I was pretty personally interested and excited for this release. It's from Yen Press. It's called I Don't Know How to Give Birth. Which, as the title implies, is about a woman and her experience with pregnancy and childbirth, which, as personally a cisgendered heterosexual woman who does one day want to have children, perhaps not now, but is sometime in the future, I think the idea of childbirth and pregnancy can be very daunting for anyone, but especially first-time mothers. I think it's a really valid story to tell. And so I was quite intrigued and quite interested. And this particular memoir is focused a lot on this woman and her choice to have children and the struggle that she had getting pregnant, her ongoing experience with IVF treatments, and her relationship with her husband, obviously. And IVF, for those who don't really know that much about it, it can be very intrusive. It's very time sensitive. There can be a lot of failure before success, and sometimes you never see success through that, you know, through in vitro. So it's a very arduous experience. It can be a very emotional experience. And our author, our memoir writer, is quite candid about, you know, having to bring her husband's sperm samples really quickly to the office so she can get it, you know, it implanted, the various ways that, you know, her having to be proactive about her body's health and, you know, wearing certain types of underwear to encourage this, that, whatever, taking all these medications to increase her fertility. And I think that's all great information. It's wonderful. I think it's a very personal account of a very emotional experience. And I think that's all really valid. I think it also, it doesn't shy away from kind of the really gross or uncomfortable or weird aspects of pregnancy, because there's a lot of weird shit going on when you're growing a child, or even when you're preparing to grow a child, right? But I will say that kind of from the get-go, I was soured on this book quite a bit, because from how she tells the story, or how she recounts this experience, she and her husband, they're both mangaka, for one. They were married for a couple years, very happy, and she was really content on them being just kind of, you know, a couple, no kids. She had never planned for kids, wasn't ever thinking about kids, and after marriage, she also wasn't really considering children.
But did he decide to be a whiny fucking baby about it?
Well, I don't know, again, because we're seeing this from her perspective, he was talking about, like, how wonderful it would be to have kids, and, like, how he always wanted to have kids, which is valid, that's fine, but she made the decision to have a child to make him happy, and I really disliked that, because I don't think that you should ever make that decision to bring a life into the world just for your partner. And especially as a woman, because you're the one doing most of the fucking labor of having a child and raising a child and all yeah. these sorts of things. It's like, okay, cool, your husband, he maybe loves kids. Could you not have gotten a pet? Like, I feel like there are steps before you bring a human life into this world. And maybe, mm-hmm. you know, and she does say that, like, she loves her child by the end of it, but it took a really long time for her to grow attached to this kid, which, again, is real, like, that's normal. I don't think it's inherently wrong or bad or unusual to not immediately feel like this maternal connection, but it just really felt very weird, like she was going through all of this trouble, all of these emotions, just because her husband was like, it would be nice to have a kid around. No, thank you. It really, as I said, soured me early on, and it really colored the perception that I had when reading the rest of it. Wherein, as I said, it's a very personal experience, and I mean, pregnancy and childbirth always is. And I appreciate how frank she was about kind of the unglamorous aspects of this whole situation. But for me, I feel like you need a bit... I just feel like there's more responsibility you have to have in place. With your whole even just relationship, right? Mm-hmm. And this isn't to fucking gatekeep who's allowed to be pregnant and who's not. But I just feel like if you're making the decision to have children just because of your partner, and you, prior to this, have literally never considered children an option, there's maybe a communication issue there that you need to have talk about before you decide to jump into fertilization or fertility treatments. Because also it's like for them it was 3 years. It was 3 years of fertility, like IVF treatments. Huge expense for throughout this entire situation. She was determined, but I don't think she was determined because she wanted a baby for herself or for this family. She was determined to like prove that she could have a kid. I don't know. It felt kind of weird. And you know, I only hope, like, I hope the best for their lovely little family. You know, I hope only the best for these new parents. But I know that there's so many people out there who have children because of obligation or because of social pressures, and it's absolutely not fair on especially the child, but the parent either, right? Like, it's just that's why I didn't like it.
Yeah, it's like, we got plenty of kids in the world.
Yeah,
you should probably have a good reason to bring in another one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I avoid pregnancy narratives in general, just because they skeeve me out on a personal level, so I have not read this.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely won't now. Alrighty. That's kind of, I think we've covered the gamut as far as the sort of very simply illustrated, webcomic-styled memoir comics, amateur comics of the last few years. I did want to mention one that's a bit older, but is in the same vein, which is called What is Obscenity? This is by the artist Roku Donashko, who is not a very good person. So do keep that in mind if you choose to go find this book. Because I do actually recommend this book. I think it's a very good read. Just keep in mind that maybe consider getting it secondhand. You know, I don't even think it's in print anymore, so I think you'd be getting it secondhand anyway. But basically, Roku Donashko, quite known for making a lot of art that is around cis female genitalia. She has these little cute little like pussy characters called like Manko-chan or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she also like had a bunch of art that she would make that was based around 3D printing her pussy.
Mm-hmm.
And making objects out of the 3D printed file. And including, she made an entire ass kayak that is molded after her pussy, which is kind of iconic. She got involved in a series of very bad lawsuits, around, like, obscene imagery, and specifically, like, sharing obscene content with her patrons, who had consented to receive this. Essentially, she sent out the file, the 3D printing file of her pussy to people who bought it with their money and consent. Yeah. So that they could make their own pussy objects. So she got involved in a lawsuit for this because Japan is very famously has very strange censorship laws, but particularly extremely strange censorship laws related to female genitalia. And this book is sort of there's a few essays throughout it as well, but for the most part, a graphic memoir of her experience with these lawsuits. And she eventually got so tired of all this shit that she fucked off to Europe, which I probably would have too, to be honest. But, this is, it's funny, and it's a very in-depth sort of wry, tongue-in-cheek, exasperated, angry journey through Japanese obscenity law. Mm-hmm. And I do recommend it, but again, that is not too... say that that I support any of what Roku Donashko's been up to, because she's, as you can imagine, very turfy for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I think this book is interesting in that it's sort of in this genre, but before the boom in this genre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A similar title, maybe not in, like, content, but in being a memoir, especially about, like, kind of an unusual specificity of a culture that we as a reader might not be a part of, have you ever read The Day I Was Forced to Marry God, or The Day I Was Forced to Divorce God?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, DMP put these out in print, I believe. And it's about a woman who her mother, she grew up within the Jehovah's Witnesses, who have very particular beliefs, like a lot of religions do. Her mother kind of brought the whole family into this religion. She'd been within the JWs for majority of her life. But
you can say cult, it's okay.
Yeah, okay. But she'd grown up within this religion, cult, community, whatever you want to call it, and kind of didn't question it. It had just been part of her life. But when her son got very, very ill and needed a blood transfusion, which is against JW's beliefs, she was then forced out of the religion, or she made the decision to leave the religion, or to leave the group, as it were, which was a very difficult decision, very difficult thing to do when you're so ingrained within a community. It's what you've known for the last 20-something years of your life. And I thought it was just a really interesting inside look at, you know, living and growing up within this particular cult, again, you know, however you want to quantify that, but also look into escaping that very, the narrative that you've always believed, and being forced to make a decision between the people you care about and a belief system that you've been ingrained in for, again, majority of your life. It's very good. And again, like, this isn't an inherently Japanese thing. JWs do exist world over. But I do think that these new religious movements, these cults, for lack of a better word, I mean, they're everywhere, but they crop up a lot in Asia, and it's a very particularly Asian experience, not just Japanese. We see this in Thailand, in Korea, in Vietnam, and everywhere. It's interesting to see the Japanese perspective on this, because we do see a lot of, like, whether it be American or European, whatever, looks at, you know, survivors of cults and survivors of JWs and Scientologists and whatever else you want to say. But we don't see a lot from this very, very large community within the Asian population of the world. So it was a really interesting insight to that.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. And yeah, Japan has a huge problem with cults.
Mm-hmm.
As a lot of, like you said, a lot of Asian countries do. But like, I have a cult flyer in my mailbox as we speak that I haven't thrown away yet, so
it's a big problem. Is it happy science?
No! So we've got this cult here. I do get Jehovah Witness flyers all the time, but the one that I get every week is from this, like, Mount Fuji worshipping cult.
Oh.
And they just drop a flyer in everybody's mailbox, and you can see when they've been... Oftentimes, like, if you throw it away too early in the day, you will find another one there.
Oh, dear.
Later. They're very persistent opossums.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, how many trees are you gonna kill before you're done?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it was interesting. Again, it really kind of predates a lot of the big boom of autobiographical manga in English, and maybe it would have done better if it had kind of ridden that wave, but I don't think it's made a lot of impact in the English speaking manga reading community, which is a shame, because it's good, it's worth reading, especially if, like, cults and, you know, these new wave religions are interesting to you, which is very interesting to me. So.
And if they are interesting to you, it's not an autobiography at all, but you should watch Mowaru Penguin Drum.
Yes. Yes.
Which is also large part about
one of my favorite, Ikuhara. Ugh. I love that series so much.
It hurts. It hurts so good.
Yeah.
Let's see. Do we want to get into some of the memoirs from well-known, I guess, mangaka that we read their other stuff as well, but also their autobiographies.
Yeah, just before we jump into that, I did want to mention one other maybe more well-known memoir that from an amateur that has,
okay,
I don't know, maybe got a lot of people more aware of it, and that's Ichi-F by Kazuto Tatsuya.
Ah, yeah.
Which is about a guy who is a worker, who has been a volunteer worker, cleaning up the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster area, and him just kind of recounting the experience of that. It's a very repetitive story. There's not a lot of differentiation between the days of cleanup and experience, and it's a 3-in-1 like omnibus. There's a lot of repetition in there, but it's an insight to one of the like larger modern tragedies of the last decade that obviously is still affecting Japanese life, and is something that I think most manga readers, especially of our vintage, are aware of. It's interesting. It's again a good insight into like that whole system of how the cleanup is going and the people who have kind of committed themselves to helping. I wouldn't personally recommend to buy it. It's a library read for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it like weirdly, I read this years ago, but mm-hmm. I found it weirdly like propaganda-y from mm-hmm. what I recall. And that's all I remember about it, being bugged by that.
Yeah. Oh, look how good the government is at cleaning up this disaster. Yeah. And you're like, all right.
Yeah. You're like, yeah, not, no. speaking of radiation and victims being failed by the Japanese government, I just remembered one that is extremely old, but yes. is also an autobiography. That is extremely worth reading. Harrowing, very difficult to read, but mm-hmm. worth it for everyone, I think, is Barefoot Gen.
Yeah.
The manga to read about Hiroshima. This is, Gen is sort of a fictionalized version of the author, but it is by and large based on an autobiographical account of his experiences as a survivor of the A-bomb.
Mm-hmm.
It's 10 volumes long, and
yeah.
the A-bomb drops in volume 1. So it's, yeah. by and large, the aftermath going into the occupation, and just the Japanese government's utter failure to do anything for these people at all. In the years after and the decades after.
Mm-hmm.
It does not hold back. There's imagery in this manga that I will never forget. It will always be there in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, you know, how must it be for people who were actually there?
Yeah.
But, you know, thank goodness it's got such a cartoony style, honestly.
Yeah, tell me about it.
You've got people shoving their own intestines back into their body. People mm-hmm. with their skin melting off of their body. People with so much glass in them that it looks like feathers. It's horrible.
Mm-hmm. It's, for those who aren't aware, this was actually the very, I don't know, this edition. You can now buy it from Last Gasp, both in hardcover and paperback edition. Hardcover might not be available anymore, but I do know that the paperback edition is. But this manga was the absolute very first manga ever to be translated into English. thanks to the hard work of the various groups within the U.S. trying to outlaw or to ban nuclear war. It was a way to bring awareness to the U.S., mostly about the atrocities of the A-bomb and, you know, the what happened within Japan after the fact, especially because so much of World War II is colored by American patriotism, especially America's, you know, involvement with Japan. So,
yeah, I mean, even I still in school was taught that it was a necessary evil. I know that's what my family believes, and I think it's a very common thing to believe in America. Even to this day.
And I think, you know, outside of political belief, outside of regardless of the just how horribly history is told, I do think that it's really important to remember that people from the U.S., people from both sides were trying to tell this story. The Japanese were trying to tell this horrible experience that they had within their own country, not just from the American, you know, bombings, but from their own government, from their own country, just absolutely rejecting them. And then, of course, America being confronted with the atrocities of what eventuates from a horrific bombing like Hiroshima, like Nagasaki. And even in that aspect, the historical context is so, so important for anyone who's kind of or has this illusion of Japan being this perfect, wonderful society that's never done anything wrong. I sure do have a whole lot of memoir manga to tell you about. but this one, I think, is very confronting in how little care or compassion was given to victims, and is an aspect of history that shouldn't be forgotten and is perfectly captured within this particular series.
Yeah, especially in the wake of the 2011 disaster and how people from Fukushima also ended up experiencing ostracization and bullying specific to their experience in the wake of nuclear disaster. You know, history repeats itself. And in a similar vein, to continue with the
horrific war crimes,
World War II, era of stuff. So you might know that Mr. Shigeru Mizuki has a very fascinating life story. We talk about Shigeru Mizuki on every podcast, and we'll continue to do so.
It's been 3 years so far. Rest assured. It'll be another 15 at this rate, Ray.
This is the Shigeru Mizuki fan podcast. I don't know if you knew that. He has some autobiographical content. I think you can talk about Nononpa, which is more related to his childhood and his fascination with yokai. But the one that I've read that is autobiographical for him is Onward Toward Our Noble Deaths, which is about his experience in the war and basically being abandoned by the Japanese military as cannon fodder. And it is full of just his rage and fury and disillusionment towards war, towards Imperial Japan, towards the Japanese government and military. And it is very good.
Onwards Towards Our Noble Death. And in a similar vein, Showa as well. His historical, you know, telling of the Showa period in which he grew up and lived a majority of his life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really notable, similarly to Barefoot Gen, in how adamantly anti-war Mizuki is, was, always was, even prior to his involvement in the war. But he experienced, so as a soldier, he was in Japanese-occupied Papua New Guinea, which was horrific. For those who don't know about the Japanese involvement in the Second World War in Asia, it's not good. It's not a good time. There's a reason a lot of Asia does not like Japan, and probably will not like Japan for a very long time.
Certainly not as long as Japan wants to deny its own war crimes.
Exactly. So again, this is the Japan, I think, is very often romanticized by a lot of manga fans, and it's a country just as horrible as every other country. Do not romanticize.
Yep.
It's past.
There's a lot of people who do that, too.
Yes.
In Japan, and they're not the kind of people you want to hang out with.
No. So, they're the anyway, kind of people regardless.
Who we have to cut out of the podcast because they're always yelling on the street. Outside my house.
Yeah. But regardless, I think Mizuki, as someone who firsthand experienced the war as just the lowest of foot soldiers in this country, where he didn't want to be, where he didn't have any patriotic loyalty to Japan, didn't want to give his life to a country that he didn't really believe in, you know, any of their tenets. It's a harrowing story of, as you said, Ray, just the throwaway nature of these Japanese soldiers who didn't have any power, who enlisted because of whether they were indoctrinated, whether they did believe in this idea, or just through social duty, who ended up giving their lives and taking so, so many lives in just mindless slaughter because some other people decided that, you know, we want more land, and we know we can do it. It's also very compassionate, which is a differentiation. It's very compassionate towards the Papua New Guineans, which is not always the case, even in anti-war manga, because xenophobia is a thing, and it always has been a thing.
Barefoot Gen as well. It's interesting how it goes about trying to, because there is a, Gen has a friend of the family from before the A-bomb who is Korean and faces a whole lot of racism and xenophobia because of that, and ends up turning to the black market after the A-bomb because nowhere will hire him or give him any money. And I thought the handling of that character was very interesting in that. It's curious. It's dated, obviously, but I think there is, it's interesting that there's an attempt there to have nuance and compassion towards non-Japanese Japanese people, like citizens living in Japan.
Yeah, absolutely. And even now, that can be too big of a hurdle for some
people. Oh my god.
which is not a good thing, just to be clear. I think Mizuki, a lot of his manga, maybe aside from Gegege no Kitaro, most of his manga is in some aspect autobiographical. Onward Towards Our Noble Death as we've talked about, is his experience during the war. It's not wholly autobiographical because the character at the end of that does die. And Mizuki thankfully survived his horrible experience in Papua New Guinea. He lost an arm for it, but he did manage to make it out alive. But I can only imagine the sheer amount of, you know, comrades in arms who he saw just throw their lives away because of bureaucracy, basically. And Nonamba, on, like, the completely opposite spectrum, Showa is more so just the whole retelling of this period. The goods, the bads, the ups, the downs. And his his retelling of it as this narrator, as this, like, outward historian. But Nonamba, I think, is very fundamental to Mizuki because it really shows where his love of the supernatural and yokai and folklore comes from. This influence of from this old woman in his own life and how in telling stories about these weird creatures and this other world that we kind of coexist within, which obviously had huge influence on his own storytelling, his own creative process. It's really good. It's really good. And it's very evocative of a period of Japan that got lost, you know, with the Taisho and with the Showa periods. Nonamba herself was a professional griever. Like, she'd just cry at graves. She'd mourn for people. And that was just how she made her living, which is not, I mean, maybe it's still a thing, but it's not in that period of him growing up, again, Taisho, early Showa, that wasn't something that Westernization allowed, right? It's not like you can't put that on your CV. You're a professional mourner. And so her understand, she was a relic of a bygone era, of a period of Japan that was slowly dying, changing, shifting because of, again, this shift to Westernization, this opening up of Japan, this globalization of Japan. It's very, very interesting. And even outside of, like, the ghost stories and the weird creatures and folklore that he learnt from this woman, it's also very evocative of that particular time as a child and the imagination and whimsy and wonder and kind of mysticism of it. That period of when you, as a kid, can believe anything because someone who's older than you says it with enough, you know, conviction. It's very, very good. And absolutely pick up the Drawn and Quarterly reprints because it's worth it.
This has been the Shigeru Mizuki fan corner of the Shigeru Mizuki fan podcast. On to the Akiko Higashimura fan corner of the Akiko Higashimura fan podcast. I feel like we've talked this series to death before. We did an episode on manga about mangaka, so I would recommend going there for our detailed thoughts about Blank Canvas, my so-called artist journey. But this is an autobiography by Akiko Higashimura, the creator of Princess Jellyfish and Tokyo Tarare Baba Girls and, like, a bunch of other things besides. And it's 5 volumes long and it's really good. More than anything, it's about her relationship with a particular art teacher that she had growing up, who really inspired her and led her to the career that she's had, but who she had quite a complicated relationship with. It's almost a love letter to him and everything that he was to her. But yeah, check out that episode to hear more. Because this is 2 hours long already, so.
Yeah, I think that's a good bridge to the other kind of autobiographical manga that we see a lot of, which is that, like, the creator story, the struggle of being an artist, which we mentioned a little bit, is very much what Blank Canvas is about. We've also seen similar stories with Insufficient Direction by Hideaki Anno.
Moyoko Anno.
Moyoko Anno. Yeah, sorry. Apologies. About her husband.
Hideaki Anno. It's Insufficient Direction by Moyoko Anno featuring Hideaki Anno.
Yes. which is just, again, that whole, like, wow, we are both creatives in this very interesting relationship, with very interesting relationship to our work. So here's our daily life. We also have seen a more maybe down to earth grounded look at the creator story with Azuin Winter by Jiro Taniguchi, which is about his kind of early years when he first moved to Tokyo and kind of breaking out as a mangaka, which is very, very Taniguchi. You either love it or you hate it. It's very, like with all Taniguchi, it's very like a boomer-esque. but it does give a pretty good insight to, like, the manga scene of the 60s and 70s. It is worth reading if that's something you're interested in. Similarly, there's stuff like A Drifting Life as well, which is about the creative process and, you know, being a nihilistic, struggling artist. There's a lot within this vein, right? Like, there's a lot of mangaka who talk about their suffering.
There are. That's kind of why I like Blank Canvas, because it's like, she's very self-aware about, like, look, I'm the one who squandered my parents' money to go to art school.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of Higashimura's strengths, is her insight and self-awareness. It always has been. It's always been a point of, like, her comedy, of her, how she tells the story. And something that I wanted to mention, it sort of aligned with this, and it's very, very recent, was the short single one-shot chapter about it, written by Koji Mori, who, about his struggle with Kentaro Miura's death and his loss of one of his best friends, and now also him continuing berserk in his place. But just the kind of shock that Miura's death was, and his reflection on a lifetime, all of his memories that he'd had with this person who he just saw as, like, larger than life, or had always been there, had been one of his closest friends, confidants, and collaborators. And I think, like, you can read it on Twitter, like, officially in English. It's not hugely, like, it's not collected in a volume or anything. It's just one artist's reflection on another artist's work, but also a very dear friend and the grief process. And I think it's really powerful and something that is very genuine to not only having lost, you know, one of these tentpole creators of manga, but a very, very dear friend who you've known for decades, and reflecting on all of the plans that, you know, now will never come to fruition. It's very good and worth a read. It's not super long. You should give it a shot if you are so interested.
I'll have to look that up. Speaking of authors who are self-aware of their own work in their memoirs, something completely different from grieving a friend. I did just want to give a shout out to the best Junji Ito manga.
Certainly my favorite.
Which is his cat diary about his cats, Yon and Mu, which he does draw entirely in the style of one of his horror manga, and it's extremely cute.
It's adorable, it's sweet, it's heartwarming, it's very relatable for any pet owner, but I'm sure especially cat owners. Man, it's a good manga, and that one particularly has a brand spanking new fancy edition from Kodansha, if you are so inclined.
The fancy feast edition. Yeah, I don't know how badly I need that, but yeah, was there any others? I think I finished out my list.
I think the well has dried. I think we've mentioned so many titles.
Yeah.
We got through them all.
Hopefully
somehow
something appeals to you. But now we have two questions to answer.
Three. We got one whilst we were recording. We have three questions.
Oh my god. Let's start from our honorary moderator, who only has one question for us this time. This is Stories on Shelves at Surried Shelves. Any autobiographical manga on your TBR that you're looking forward to reading?
Yes.
So there's this Japanese one that I read called Jitsuroku Hoikushi Deko Sensei. Which is about a daycare worker. And she's actually, the author is a woman, but she draws herself as this big beefy man that I guess was a character she had in middle school. I've read one volume and I have the next two. I just haven't read them yet, but it's so cute. she perfectly captures these little gremlin snot babies, and what makes them so wonderful and so terrifying. She gets the child stink faces just perfect, and I really enjoy this one a lot. It also makes me cry a lot when it gets into its more heartwarming parts about how wonderful it is to watch these little human beings, like, become people. And, like, their various relationships with their parents and stuff. Yeah, it's cute. So I need to catch up on that one.
It also reminds me that we didn't mention the best memoir manga of all, which is Skullface Bookseller Honda-san, but...
It's true. I think also in the manga about manga podcast, you can hear our thoughts on...
Yes, yeah,
Skullface Bookseller Honda-san.
Aside from Until I Meet My Husband, or Until I Met My Husband, which is on my to-be-read list because I haven't gotten it yet, I will read it once I acquire it. There's a title that, who licensed it? I want to say Seven Seas licensed it, which is called I'm a Terminal Cancer Patient, But I'm Fine, which sounds interesting. Obviously, it's a pretty heavy topic, as tends to be the case with Seven Seas memoirs. It also reminds me of a Ponemon memoir called I Wish I Could Say Thank You, or I Hope I Can Say Thank You, something along those lines, about a woman who's dealing with her her mother's late stage pancreatic cancer and having to like reconcile or trying to reconcile their very tumultuous relationship in her mother's last days. I don't know how good I'm a terminal cancer patient, but I'm fine will be. But I do think that it will provide interesting insight to a situation that a lot of people, I think, are very afraid of, both for themselves and for people who they care about. And seeing somebody telling their story about their experience, whether it's hard, whether it's, you know, surprisingly pretty easy, or their up and down emotions of it, the struggle with acceptance, the struggle with, you know, living their life to the fullest or not, you know, the decisions you make when you're given a deadline, quote unquote, as it were, would I think be fairly interesting. And again, especially cancer is like so prevalent in people's lives, and it is a very real fear for a lot of people, that I think this kind of story is very powerful and is worth reading. So hopefully it's good. I don't know, because I haven't read it, but hopefully it's good. And I'm pretty sure the creator draws themselves as a cute bunny. So, you know.
Nice. The next question that we have is from Chio. Is there a particular author, deceased or alive, that you'd wish would or would have made an autobiographical manga, and what aspects of their lives or career would you like for it to focus on?
Do you have one, Ray?
Yeah! Okay, so, once again, I would like for the, extremely bitter, trauma-filled book that Miss Hagio has come out with to be turned into a graphic memoir about how much she hates Keiko Takemiya. Thank you. That's all.
So, same as always. I agree. I'd love to read that. I mean, that already exists. Another one that already exists that I'd be really interested to read is Naoko Takeuchi's kind of blog, daily log of the day-to-day with herself and her husband, Yoshihiro Togashi. I know there's various little comics that she's done in regards to that, and I'd like to read it in some capacity, because she's amazing. He's a bit of a mess, but I like his work. and I'd like to, I think they have a really solid relationship despite it all. And it's nice to see, you know, this power couple just absolutely fucking thrive. And continue to create the weird shit that they want to, and be able to live on, like, the royalties of their youth. So, yeah, I'd like to read their weird little relationship that they have, because it's lasted this long. They must be doing something right.
Thank you. Any other year 24 artist who wants to write a graphic memoir, I would love to read that as well.
I know he kind of like puts himself into every single one of his works, but I would love to read a Tatsuki Fujimoto. Oh my god, Tatsuki Fujimoto autobiography one of these days. Because I think crazy. It would be wild. And I don't know. I like his stuff, and I like an insight into the weird, wonderful person that he seems to be.
I think I would like in the style of Fumi Yoshinaga's Not Love But Delicious Foods make me so happy.
Mm-hmm.
I would like him to do wrap-ups of film festivals.
His favorite movies. Give him just, like, the 5-star treatment, and everything will be, like, either a 5-star or, like, a negative 10-star. There's no in-between.
But yeah. And then the last question that we got is from at Zakasa 2049. Which autobiographical manga impacted or resonated with you the most?
Personally, I really enjoyed, My Brain is Different. I don't have, I don't have a developed mental disorder, but I do have people in my family who do. I think it was, we've talked at length about it, but I think it was very, very good. I also, I mean, Nagisa Kabi's work is always very powerful, very emotionally effective. And I, as I also, another title that we mentioned, quite extensively, or I talked about, was, A Life Turned Upside Down, as someone who does have alcoholism on both sides of my family. Thankfully, not directly, but I've seen the impact that it's had on so many people that I care about. It's something that I see very strongly, and is something that I think the nuanced take was very, very good. But I think the power of autobiography or memoir does mean that you can, like, there's just so many different stories to tell, even if they're not directly related to you. And even stuff like The Day I Married God, wherein I do have an interest in these kind of cult situations and the mentality of breaking out of them. Yeah, there's a lot to really like, and there's a lot of very different stories. Plus, also, The Bride Was a Boy is really sweet and lovely, and I'm so happy that she has such a wonderful relationship in life, and I'm very happy for her. That's it. That's my answer.
Let's see. Probably, yeah, My Brain is Different is the one that resonated with me the most, because, I do have ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's definitely pertained to me in a very personal way. And again, like, same as you, like, I think Nagata Kabi's stuff is always very impacting. Yeah, those are probably the ones that I would say that Blank Canvas also,
mm-hmm.
Spoke a lot to me as someone who was an art student for 4 years, and ended up taking a different path, and, you know, seeing in her art teacher some of the traits that I recognized in my own plethora of art teachers I've gone through. Yeah. Probably those.
Mm. I will say that, like, although I complained about one particular title in this podcast, and Ray, I know you're not particularly drawn to memoir, there is a lot of really good memoir out and about and available right now. If it is something that you're interested in, it's a little bit different from the typical, you know, fiction fare that we get. And there's a lot on offer, so it is worth checking out if it is something that you want to try. But yep. I think with that, we've come to the end of the podcast. Again, can you believe it's been 3 years? Oh my goodness.
It's been 3 years, and guess what, G?
What?
After 5 years in Japan, guess what I'm doing next month?
Well, I know, but do you want to tell our wonderful listeners?
I'm moving back to the USA. After 5 years on the JET program. So that means that I have a lot to do in order to move internationally. Which means that at this very nice cutting off point, straight 3 years of podcasts, that's purely by chance, but it turned out nicely. We will be taking a 1 month break, next month because I do not have time, for podcasting. So
it's the end. Yeah, it's the end of our, I guess, very long first season. We're taking a break.
This is the season one finale right here.
We will be back with a vengeance in August. And I think we'll announce the topic a little bit closer to recording time, but it's an exciting one. It'll be a fun one. And I think a good jumping off point for our new season to get straight into it. And so it's really exciting. I'm very happy for Ray to be going back to the US, continuing her education. It seems like she's got lots of big plans. And it'll be sad because now you're on the opposite side of the world to me. But fear not, dear listeners. We will be able to figure it out somehow, some way.
Can I give a hint as to our August topic, G?
Sure, you can.
My birthday is next month.
And that's all the hint you need, wonderful listeners. So, no questions for next month, although we do really appreciate everyone who did send in your questions for this month. Thank you so, so much. I hope you enjoyed listening to the podcast. There's a lot to talk about, lots of titles to discuss. And although we are taking this little break, be sure to, you know, not forget us. It's only a month. We promise we'll be back. And if you can't wait until then, you can find all of our episodes on pretty much every podcasting platform, as well as my YouTube channel, Simply G. But you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, the Stitcher, the other one. It's everywhere. You can listen to us everywhere. And if you are so inclined, please do rate and review us, because that would be really nice if you did, especially if you enjoy listening to us. But yes, thank you so, so much for listening. We are halfway through the year. Look after yourselves, everyone, and we will see you in the next episode. Bye till then.
Bye, guys.